Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 297. I'm Patrick Gray. And this week's show, like last week's, is a little bit different. I am still in the process of moving house, which includes moving the Risky Business office and studio and my whole life and a whole bunch of other crap because I've been in the same house for 4 years. But everything should be back to normal next week. So there is no news segment in this week's show. Sorry about that. But we have two great feature interviews with academic cryptographers for you. First is with Johns Hopkins University's Matthew Green, who was actually asked to remove a blog post critical of the NSA from the university's servers last week. You might have heard about that in last week's show. That led to a pretty massive controversy. So we're going to get his side of the story, and that is a great interview. Peter Goodman of the University of Auckland also joins us in this week's podcast. He is another well-known crypto academic, and I'll be getting his thoughts on the NSA's covert program to subvert public crypto. Now, I do cover some of the same ground with Peter as I do with Matthew, but as you'll hear, they have slightly different perspectives on these things. So it's definitely worth hearing from the both of them. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, makers of fine, fine vulnerability scanning software and SIEM gear. And you know what? The vuln scanning world has changed pretty substantially in the last 5 to 10 years. You used to use vuln scanners to prioritize which of your awfully out-of-date Windows boxes you'd like to patch. But these days, you're more likely to use that stuff to find machines that simply aren't being managed or machines you didn't even know about. Ron joins us to talk about that, and Tenable has also released version 4 of its passive vulnerability scanner, which is actually pretty interesting. You can just plug it into a span port, and it tells you a lot very quickly, which is actually handy for consulting engagements. So yeah, chat about that coming up later. But let's get stuck into the features now. And many of you would have heard that Johns Hopkins University Professor Matthew Green, whose field of expertise is cryptography, was asked to remove a blog post from the university's servers last week. The blog post was about revelations the NSA has been actively and covertly undermining public cryptography standards. So I got Matthew on the line and asked him to tell us what happened.
Well, so last Monday I got an email from my dean, the interim dean of engineering, saying that I had he had noticed my blog post. He had been informed by somebody that might be hosting or linking to classified information. He hadn't read the post, but he was essentially requesting right then that I take it down. He also mentioned that it used the NSA logo. Didn't really explain why that was a problem, but that was an issue. And then suggested that I should probably get an attorney if I wanted to continue doing scholarly research in this area.
Wow. So, I mean, now you say that the dean was informed by someone. Do you have any idea who that someone was?
Yeah, what I've been given to understand is that, and I didn't understand this for at least a day or two, but that there is a branch of Johns Hopkins called the Applied Physics Laboratory that does classified research. It's Johns Hopkins kind of not really part of the NSA, not really part of the Department of Defense, but working for the Department of Defense. So kind of in that in-between world between the university and the government. A bunch of really good, really smart people, but they have some rules, I guess, that you know, if somebody comes across what they think is classified information, even if it's been all in all the newspapers, they have to report it, and the university takes that very seriously.
Okay, but I mean, this is a bit of a trouble already. I'm seeing a bit of a problem here, which is blurring the lines between where the DoD NSA start and the university ends. I mean, that just seems a strange arrangement in terms of allowing academic freedom. How can you have academic freedom at a university when it's so enmeshed in that type of activity, you know?
Well, I mean, there are definitely some problems with that. I mean, the whole idea of APL, which is the Applied Physics Lab, was to have a part of the university that, you know, could kind of live under the, you know, university rules, but also be kind of working for the government. And the idea was that the idea that you can have these two things together has always been a little bit of a thorny idea, and I guess maybe it didn't work so well the other week.
So it was someone from APL who actually ratted you out on this?
It's my understanding that somebody somewhere in APL did something, and that somehow it went way up a totem pole in APL and then went, you know, left over to the university and then came down like a ton of bricks on me. So that's my understanding, is I came from APL. For a little while, I didn't know that. I still don't absolutely know that, but I think it really did come from APL.
Now, the interesting thing, I guess, about this is the reaction from the media was absolutely massive. I mean, I fully understand that because, you know, I've been a journalist for quite a long time, so, 12 years or so. And, you know, academics are a very important part of the sort of storytelling that goes with being a journalist. You have to be able to ring up people who are independent. They have to be free to make comments without worrying about political retribution, without worrying too much about undermining their own corporate agenda because they don't have one. So academics are a really, sacred thing to the journalist, which is why I believe there was that huge reaction. But were you surprised by it?
Well, I was really surprised by it. I mean, I was glad to get some support because I think that that made a lot of difference for me. I like I said, I spent a lot of Monday thinking I was going to be looking for a new job. By the end of Monday, when I saw how this had blown up, well, then I really thought I was going to be looking for a new job. But after I saw the way that the university was reacting to it and how they were, you know, they were running away from this and they were making clear they'd overreacted, then I realized that, you know, I'm glad there are people out there who care about this.
Now, in last week's show, we suggested that perhaps you'd spent last week keeping your head down because of this controversy. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole bunch of reasons that I want to keep my head down. I mean, for obvious reasons, there are people who probably rightly think that this was a huge overreaction. And it was a huge overreaction. It absolutely was. Those people are absolutely right. And some of those people are a little bit, I don't want to be going around saying that I'm some kind of hero of free speech because I'm not. I'm just a guy who wrote a blog post and some slightly bad things happened to me. I was trying to keep that down. I also don't want the university to feel that I'm going around saying bad things about them because I love the university and it's a great place to work.
But that's kind of the point, Matthew, is that that's the chilling effect. That is exactly, you just defined the chilling effect. You don't want to say it. You are compelled to not want to talk to the media. I mean, this is kind of what has worried people about it. Do you sort of see that perspective?
It was something that I wish hadn't happened. I wish that I wasn't even having this conversation today. So I guess you're right that there is definitely an effect. I feel like I can still do everything I was able to a week and a half ago, maybe even more. But yeah, definitely there was an effect.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, let's get into, what I initially wanted to interview you about last week was not this blog post being pulled down. It was actually the content of the blog post because I read it and I have to say it was a fantastic bit of work. I mean, you've written some really great stuff about the latest NSA revelations. And I suppose, being someone who is very much involved in the crypto world, you probably have some thoughts on the latest revelations beyond even what you've published in that blog post. But in essence, you kind of feel like there's been a pretty major betrayal of the tech community by the NSA.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think that there have never been any written rules, but my understanding was that there were certain kind of gentlemen's agreements. Now, I know that sounds a little silly when we're talking about a spy agency, but I always understood there were some rules. And the rules that I understood were, that you don't spy on U.S. citizens, which I sort of assumed that was the entire basis of what the NSA operated under. And the other rule was that you don't tamper and damage, you don't tamper with and damage U.S. technology in order to spy on foreign interests. And of course, I'm speaking purely as a U.S. citizen. I think that as a non-U.S. citizen, you probably have a lot of other legitimate concerns about the NSA, but I'm just trying to speak narrowly from my experience. The most narrow thing that I can say about the NSA is that if you put backdoors in crypto software and hardware, it's very hard to make sure you're the only one who can exploit those backdoors. And so I think that what's happened is kind of the NSA has said, well, we need to spy so badly that we're willing to make the United States less secure and the whole world less secure to do it. I think that is a bad call.
Now, you mentioned the back doors, but we don't really know many specifics, do we? I mean, to what extent do we know how badly the NSA has actually interfered with public cryptography standards?
We, and again, this is all straight out of these news articles, but we know that they collaborated with NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, in the United States, and also with some unnamed international bodies, to actually put standards, to alter standards that specify how crypto should work. So we know that they've been making these changes. And that's just kind of worrisome, because NIST is actually charged with coming up with standards to make the U.S. more secure. So when they tamper with these things to make them less secure, this is actually, it's not just all fair, in love and war. This is actually somebody, I think, violating the law and violating the spirit of the law.
I think it's cheating too, because everyone seems to accept that organizations like the NSA have the right to try to find vulnerabilities in cryptographic systems and not tell anyone about it and use those vulnerabilities to decrypt data. But it seems like as soon as they go that extra step, which is to start undermining standards, it's almost like they're cheating. You know, as we'd say in Australia, it's just not cricket.
Well, you know, I mean, there's always been a debate. So, for example, when bin Laden was being sought after, there was an incident where I believe somebody used the cover of being a doctor giving out vaccines. And there was some concern in the medical community that this might make people in some countries afraid to receive vaccines because they'd feel like this profession was being misused. Now, I think that hopefully is not going to be a global phenomenon, but this really could be, in a sense. You have these crypto standards that everybody has to rely on, but now a lot of people are going to turn away from them because they think that they're backdoored. I think that could actually make a lot of information security systems less trustworthy.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, Brian Snow, who's funnily enough, you know, ex-NSA, he was a technical director of information assurance at the NSA, and in conversations he's had with me on this podcast, he's spoken about the concept of a trust bubble. And, you know, it's almost like he was talking about this, the possibility of this happening one day, which is that something might happen which would cause that trust bubble to explode and all of a sudden people would lose confidence in technology. Do you think it seems to me that what you're saying is that could happen right now, is that there'll be, that confidence is shattered, that NIST's credibility is gone, that the credibility of all of these published standards is all of a sudden under question.
Yeah, I think that there is a lack of trust. How it's going to play out, I don't know. I think the best thing we have going for us is that, fortunately, nobody ever took the security industry all that seriously in the first place. So maybe not being able to trust anyone will just make us only marginally worse off than we were before. But, you know, joking aside, I do think it's a really bad thing, and I think that NIST kind of not being able to, you know, stand up and say we're doing this thing to make America more secure, the world more secure, I think that hurts us all.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, you know crypto intimately. I mean, it is your area of expertise. Is it possible to have a guess at which types of algorithms and standards are, you know, more likely to be secure given these revelations? I mean, I would have thought, you know, very publicly reviewed bits of code like OpenSSL might be okay, for example.
Well, so the problem is that SSL, even without the NSA getting involved, has been already kind of falling apart in a bunch of different ways. We found a bunch of kind of not incredibly important, but you know, practical problems with SSL deployments. So that's kind of one thing that, you know, with just a few pushes in the right direction, you could see problems with SSL. The other thing I think people are looking at right now, I think a lot of the focus has been on these random number generators that NIST was pushing back in 2006, because the New York Times and the Guardian report specifically mentioned specifications that were put out by NIST in 2006. So a lot of people are looking at these. There's been a lot of speculation that elliptic curve crypto, which, you know, everybody who thinks about crypto, elliptic curve crypto is the kind of the future crypto we're all supposed to be using. There's been a lot of speculation that there could be something wrong with NIST's elliptic curve crypto. And then you get into wild speculation about people being able to break RSA and RC4. The problem is that nobody knows. It could be any or all or none of the things I just listed.
Well, and that's why it's such a crisis of confidence. So what are the next steps? I mean, how do we go about actually creating technology that we can feel confident using again?
Well, I mean, the good news is that we know that the NSA would not be cheating if they, you know, they wouldn't be putting these backdoors in if they could break RSA or that, you know, at proper key strengths, or if they could break, you know, properly implemented cryptography. So we have reason to believe that we know how to build crypto that's fairly secure. So the question now is, how do we actually build, you know, real systems that aren't going to have backdoors at some level and aren't going to be vulnerable at some level? And that's a hard, hard question. I think we can do it, but I think it's just going to be a long process figuring it out.
And what about a political response?
I would like to see somebody in the Intelligence Committee in the Senate look into these allegations and make sure that this kind of tampering stops. I don't know how that process happens. I don't know how it gets done in a way that everybody can be confident it happened. But that's what I really like to see come out of this.
You'd think it would have to be something quite big, wouldn't you?
I think it would have to be something. I mean, it's hard. There's so much classified information here. It's hard to see how our system could even process it. But I would like to see something very serious happen.
Now, I mean, another aspect to this that I don't think has been written about that extensively is it's almost like, you know, everyone assumed that the crypto wars ended sort of 12, you know, 13 years ago. What they don't seem to have realized is that the crypto wars just went covert. I mean, it is a continuation of that same thing that we all thought we dealt with in the 90s, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, I didn't like the crypto wars much when they were overt and they were saying that you had to use certain kinds of crypto with government backdoors. But I really don't like this world either. I guess I'd rather be in this world where at least we have a chance of being secure than the other one where everything was going to have an obvious backdoor in it. That was a big time with the export restrictions and everybody testing the law. That was an interesting time.
Now, look, I mean, obviously you've been following the Snowden revelations. Did your opinion, were you immediately quite alarmed with the first revelations, or were you more like me where it took you some time to really be convinced that the NSA had gone too far?
Well, I mean, I think that the three most shocking revelations for me, obviously the crypto thing has been very big for me because that's my field. But, you know, the most shocking revelations for me are the collection of U.S. call records. It's really evident that the mission of the NSA has changed away from simply pointing outside of the U.S. to actually turning it around and pointing it, you know, potentially kind of at the heart of our democracy. That kind of worries me. The other thing that really shocked me, which I don't think got enough play, got a lot, but not enough, is that a lot of raw signals intelligence is being shared with foreign partners. I think there was an article in The Guardian a week or two ago about the NSA sharing raw intelligence with Israel. And so, well, Israel is, you know, our ally, and I know a lot of wonderful people in Israel. It doesn't mean that I want every piece of raw intelligence, including intelligence on U.S. citizens, going to a foreign power where we have no control over it. So that really worries me.
Now, it seems that, you know, to meet the definition of a whistleblower, you need to be unveiling illegal conduct. Edward Snowden initially didn't appear to be doing that, but I think, you know, he keeps reaching into that bottomless briefcase of his, and he has actually unveiled some serious misconduct on behalf of the government. I mean, conduct so serious, in fact, that the NSA was in a great deal of trouble with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court over, you know, lying to it, essentially. So would you be surprised if Edward Snowden actually manages to return to the United States within 5 to 10 years?
I wish that were the case. I wish we lived in a world where that were the case, but I don't think that's going to happen. And the reason that's not going to happen is that, you know, for every document that has 90% valuable information that's really, you know, in the public's right to know, I think there's that little scrap of information that really probably is within the NSA's mission and might actually damage some of their operations. And I think as long as that's the case, it's always going to be a problem. It's never going to be something you can just kind of sweep under the rug.
So he's screwed.
I think that on balance, he gave us a lot of information we needed, but I don't think it's going to be an easy situation.
Okay, well, Matthew Green, we're very glad to hear that the dean at Johns Hopkins University did apologize to you for requesting that you remove that blog post. I've really enjoyed your writing on this topic, and I'm looking forward to your further posts, and thanks a lot for joining the show.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Matthew Green of Johns Hopkins University there. We're going to continue our discussion of the NSA's covert program to screw up everyone's security now with Peter Gutman of the University of Auckland. I started off by asking him how he'd go about undermining crypto standards if he was the NSA.
Well, if you look at some of the IETF designed by committee stuff, I don't think you need to do much undermining. and particularly like IPsec, for example, that's already such a mess that you don't really need to do that much more undermining. And that's been some of the debate on mailing lists is, have they actually done anything to undermine it, or is that just the natural progress that leads to such crap standards?
So, in other words, the NSA, you think it is beyond the capability of the NSA to actually make things worse?
Well, it's not so much that they don't have the talent to do it. It's more that it's already so bad that what more can you do? But certainly, you know, it's very hard to tell the difference between a badly run design by committee effort and a deliberately sabotaged effort.
Yeah, now, I mean, if you had to guess, I mean, how successful would you say these types of programs could be? Do you think that this crisis of confidence that seems to be sweeping through the InfoSec community is justified, or do you think it's an overreaction?
I think it may be an overreaction, and in particular, the focus on, you know, let's say deliberately weakened crypto algorithms is probably an overreaction. A lot of those things, like, for example, AES, that was designed in a very public manner. It was a public competition. there was lots of public analysis. It's got a long history of, you know, a very long pedigree of previous designs that were tried and broken. However, what you can do is if you wanted to screw up a standards committee, I mean, standards committees barely hang together as it is. So if you have someone in there who's hostile and deliberately trying to sabotage things, then that's not very hard to do. So what I'd attack is attack the key management, attack the way the keys are used, attack the way the protocol's deployed, attack everything else, because that's a very, very easy target. My main concern about this is people getting all paranoid about all the you know, sort of tinfoil hattery and the weird stuff the NSA is doing. Any well-engineered protocol should be able to resist an organization like the NSA. So you don't have to worry about these exotic, bizarro attacks. Just use a well-engineered protocol and make sure it's deployed in the appropriate manner. And that should be fairly resistant to attack. You don't need a specific magical NSA-proof protocol to do that.
But people are throwing some question marks around about AES. I mean, you would acknowledge that that's happening.
Yeah, but everything we know about it is that it's pretty safe.
Pretty safe. You're brimming with confidence there, Peter.
Hey, I'm a cryptographer. You know, I hedge my bets. But, you know, it's about as safe as we can get. And if you're starting to worry about the underlying algorithms, is AES safe? Is RSA safe? Is Diffie-Hellman safe? Well, what do you fall back on? Then you start falling back on these weird alternative algorithms that haven't been that heavily tested, haven't been that heavily analyzed. And they may be a lot less safe, even though they're less well-known, than the public ones like AES, because that's been through, as I mentioned earlier, this big public analysis process.
Now, what are your thoughts on how we can best actually move forward in light of these revelations, in light of the fact that perhaps we can't fully trust organizations like NIST? What do you expect will happen, and what do you think should happen?
Ooh, that's hard to say. That's getting into what I call Stano-millinery. Stano being tin and millinery being of making hats. You know, you can get into all sorts of weird tinfoil hat stuff, but you know, for example, someone suggested using multiple different encryption algorithms and encrypting data with each of those in turn on the assumption that at least one of them hasn't been subverted by the NSA. But again, you know, the algorithms are probably reasonably strong. What they're going to go for is the key management, the key exchange, the procedures you're using for sending keys and attacking the endpoints. It doesn't matter if you've got some super-duper mega encryption going to Gmail, if the NSA is going in with a national security letter to Google and saying, give us the plaintext.
No, look, that's true. But, I mean, there are many organizations that use crypto, which isn't just SSL-based. You know, I mean, there's encryption is bigger than just trafficking data to and from companies like Google and Facebook.
Sure. And, you know, there's things like SSH. So, you know, how many people actually check the entire SSH fingerprint? There's a technique called fuzzy fingerprints where you can generate a fingerprint that's a reasonably close match to the actual fingerprint. And unless you check all 160 bits of the fingerprint, it's very easy to fake. And I did an informal survey a couple of years ago, as did someone in the US, of tech support people at the organizations they worked at to see whether anyone had ever bothered doing an out-of-band verification of an SSH fingerprint. And in both cases, we found no one had ever done this out-of-band verification. So spoofing SSH would be relatively simple. You just substitute a different key with a new fingerprint and do a man-in-the-middle attack. And again, that's an easy attack. It's much easier than breaking the crypto.
Now, you're pointing towards, some technical stuff here, you know, like what we can do technically and what's paranoia and what isn't. But, I mean, you would admit that there is some systemic issues that have been uncovered here, wouldn't you? That the NSA is actually actively undermining certain standards, and perhaps we should try to steer some of the standards picking away from organizations that have been tarred by this whole thing?
Well, the problem with the standards is, if you look at, for example, the IETF standards, anyone can attend, anyone can contribute. And in some cases, you know, NSA people have turned up, and they typically say Department of Defense, Fort Meade, or something like that. But it could also be some random guy representing some, you know, one-man software engineering company. But if the NSA sent them in to sabotage the standard, you can't really tell who's doing it. So, you know, because they are open standards, you can't really tell whether the person who's screwing up the entire standard is simply an idiot or is doing it deliberately.
So how do we get around this? I mean, do we get more selective and snobby about who gets to go on committees to make it harder for people to try to sabotage the process? I mean, what can we do here?
I don't know if it's actually that easy to stop that. If you've got an insider who's determined to sabotage things, then they can, by using all the standard tricks of a committee, you know, sort of objections and points of order, and that's not going to scale, and all, you know, the usual rubbish. A determined person can completely screw up a standard, and you can't tell whether they're doing it, as I said, whether they're doing it deliberately, whether they're just being an idiot. So I think just open standards and open vetting of the standards is one way to deal with that. But in general, there's no obvious defence.
Now, are there standards that you are more confident in than others in light of the of Snowden's bottomless briefcase?
Well, there are standards. You look at them and you can say, you know, these are reasonably well analysed and reasonably secure. Now, regardless of whether that was deliberate NSA sabotage or just designed by committee, you know, I wouldn't trust IPsec because it's such a mess and so complicated that you don't know what it's going to do or whether it's working the way it should. SSL, for example, was reasonably well designed and is, as far as we know, reasonably secure. Regardless of whether the NSA tried to sabotage it or not, the outcome is a reasonably robust standard.
Now, obviously, you're an academic yourself. You would have followed the news about Matthew Green's blog post getting yanked off the Johns Hopkins University blog last week. What did you make of all of that, Peter?
I suspect it was just university bureaucracy overreacting. You know, they were worried that he was going to, he'd said something that was going to upset people and shut him down because of that. I can't imagine the NSA would have gone in and said, shut this guy up, because that's just a, you know, Streisand effect. That's the last thing you want to do.
Yeah, I mean, but that said, isn't it troublesome that we've entered this situation where people at the university, I mean, I've spoken to him, it seems that an NSA-linked lab there actually had something to do with asking it to be pulled. Isn't it a concern when we've actually got this organizational culture at a university which actually moves to censor someone? I mean, isn't that violating the core principle of academic freedom?
Oh, absolutely. And it goes beyond the universities. You know, we've got this government agency which seems to be sort of completely out of control and is spying on everybody they can, whether they've been suspected of a crime or not. So it goes beyond just censoring academic research under the sort of overarching umbrella of surveillance that they really shouldn't be doing.
So you believe that the NSA has gone too far?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, their point is to defend the US against foreign enemies, not to do domestic surveillance and carry out domestic operations.
And what do you think should happen? Do you think that a wide, you know, a far-reaching, serious government inquiry, I mean, I suppose the equivalent in Australia and perhaps New Zealand, I'm not sure if you have them there as well, but Royal Commission, you know, the equivalent of a Royal Commission?
I would say so, but then again, can you see that happening in the US?
Well, I don't know, because I think we're entering uncharted territory here, because it's turning into every time Alexander gets up and says something in the NSA's defense, out comes another document. I mean, it's like Snowden has an unlimited supply of these things and he's going to keep embarrassing them until something happens.
Right. But then if you look at, you know, the polls of the US public, where the majority are in favor of the NSA listening in on anyone they want in order to, quote, catch terrorists, it doesn't seem like there's that much public demand for anything to be fixed.
But public demand is led by the commentariat to a degree, right? And when you've got Sarah Palin and, you know, left-wing organisations, when you've got Sarah Palin agreeing with the ACLU, I mean, it kind of looks like a political problem, you know?
That's kind of weird. But then, you know, if you look at the history of the Church Committee, I mean, the last time this happened was in the 70s, and there were three separate government inquiries into this. The first one was a complete whitewash, the second one was a bit of a whitewash, and the third one was still, to some extent, a whitewash. So, you know, the fact that with outrageous abuses in the 1970s, it took three separate congressional inquiries to get anything done means, and that was, you know, in the 1970s, not now, where you can do anything in the name of terrorism. I would be surprised if much happened. There'll be some token shuffling around and you know, we're sorry and we won't do it again. And then I suspect it'll be business as usual.
Well, I think there's going to be a lot more innovation going into crypto as a result of this. I mean, that's one positive that's come out of it. I mean, I would think that the mere existence of a program like Prism is actually kind of good news, because if you could just break everything, you wouldn't need it.
Right. That is to some extent a good thing. But the other problem is, if you look at a lot of the debate that's been going on about crypto lists, it's very unfocused. Everybody's got their own ideas on these cool things we can do, but there doesn't seem to be any one thing saying, you know, we will modify a widely used protocol. And let's face it, on the internet, the most widely used sort of secure tunneling protocol is SSL. So we will try and make SSL more resistant to Prism kind of stuff. Everyone has their own pet projects that they're working on. So it's a very unfocused response, unfortunately.
And do you expect that will change?
I don't think so, because a problem with this is that we know the NSA is doing bad things, but they haven't actually given us an exact shopping list of all the things they've done. So everybody's responding to their own perceived threats rather than, you know, responding to any documented thing that the NSA has actually done.
You know, it's not outside of the realm of possibility that the NSA is interfering in open source projects that aren't related to cryptography. I mean, introducing a bug here, a bug there. I mean, that's conceivable too, isn't it?
It's certainly conceivable, but then again, you've got the same thing as the design by committee thing. How do you distinguish an NSA-induced bug from a bug that the developers put in there without even knowing about it?
Well, it's a very good point. You can't. I think that's why they're doing it.
Right. Well, alternatively, they could just go out there and buy a bunch of Oday and exploit it without having to bother about manipulating the open source stuff.
Well, I think they do that as well.
Right.
All righty. Well, Peter Gutman, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a chat about all of this crazy business with the NSA.
You're welcome.
Peter Gutman there. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Ron Gouler of Tenable Network Security. Funnily enough, Ron actually worked at the NSA many, many years ago, but since then he's had a pretty amazing career in the civilian infosec sector. He founded and later sold Network Security Wizards, and then went on to co-found Tenable. Tenable makes SIEM and vulnerability scanning gear, but it's a game that's changed in the last 5 to 10 years. You used to use vulnerability scanners in a reactive way. Do a scan, find out what you need to patch, and then roll it out. But these days, your vulnerability scanner shouldn't even trip if everything is working well, which, you know, of course it doesn't. So Tenable has actually done a pretty significant release of its passive vulnerability scanner, which is a nice approach, really. You just plug this thing into a span port or, you know, throw it on your gateway and off you go. And that is a good way to see if something pops up that you didn't know about or something that's not managed. So as you'll hear, Ron says these days, vuln scanners are most useful in this way. Here he is.
So when I was at the NSA, I kind of made a habit. Whenever I did a pen test, I would go and I would try to find out where that machine was physically and talk to those people. But now at Tenable, whenever I have a knowledge of a customer who got compromised, right, I can't name any names or things like that, but I can discreetly find out, hey, what was the exploit? How did they break in? What did they do? What are you going to do next? What are you going to change now that you've been broken into that you weren't doing before? 99 times out of 100, what somebody says is the machine was just not being managed, right? If it was being patched, it wasn't being patched 100%. Maybe it was being patched for Windows, but not third-party software, right? If it was an internet-facing service, maybe they were doing light uncredentialed scans, but they weren't doing a full patch audit. There's always some sort of obvious gee whiz, hindsight's 2020 item that says, yes, we could have done more. Now, that's a really easy thing to say in 2020, you know, looking back, that we could have done more. But what's hard is to kind of pick that one thing that I could tell your listeners, that, look, you need to do this, and you won't get attacked, you won't get compromised. Because if an adversary wants to break into you, they can always just spend a little bit more resources than what you're doing to protect yourself, and they can break in. But the thing is a lot of these guys that are getting broken in, it's like they're not even trying.
Yeah.
Patch is 30 days out of date. You know, no system hardening, you know, no firewalls on the internet, right? Now, trying to put a number on that, trying to say what percentage, it's really, really difficult to do that. But, you know, a lot of the times it's really, really basic stuff.
Now, I'd imagine, too, that, you know, you'd have the example of a freshly installed Windows box popping up onto a network presenting some problems and, you know, passive vulnerability scanners at the gateway would tend to pick that sort of thing up, which is really cool. But, you know, when we look at the way that Windows, generally speaking, is managed at the moment, I can't imagine that people are really using vulnerability scanners to keep an eye on Windows bugs, because it really has become quite easy to manage your operating system patches, hasn't it?
It is. So if you're a modern, you know, Microsoft shop, you're pushing patches with tools from Microsoft, you know, WSUS if you're, you know, got gray hair, SCCM if you've been doing it the last couple of years, or maybe even some third-party software, you know, from IBM, from CA, from a whole plethora of people. The issue with the automation of pushing patches and pushing software is that these tools often give you sort of a false sense of security. They will tell you that, you know, 100% of things are patched. And one of the things that we've done at Tenable is we've actually had the ability to put into Nessus to cross-reference what the patch management tool thinks versus what the scanner thinks.
That's actually that's a really cool feature. I like that idea. So you can tell when SCCM or WSUS is lying to you.
It's lying, or it's why technically something is showing up the way it is. But basically, you know, after, you know, we have so many different Nessus users all over the world, and we would often get a ticket, hey, Nessus scanned a host, full patch audits, we know the DLL, we know the version, we know the plugin's correct, and yet, you know, the patch management folks says, nope, we push Microsoft, you know, 01253. Yet we know from our debug that that's not on there. Well, what is the case for that? Well, maybe the machine needs to be rebooted to finish the install. well, maybe it got orphaned, right? Maybe you pushed a patch from Big Fix or whatever, and you have 1,000 patches out there. For some reason, the machine's at a disk space. There's a million reasons why a patch didn't get pushed, and that perhaps the patch management system thought it was pushed.
How common is that, and which are the biggest offenders? I mean, you mentioned WSAS, SCCM. Which are the solutions that tend to screw up the least?
Well, this is the issue, right? If you are a Microsoft environment, you have something called a security policy. You have something called GPO. Your IT people will start rolling out their own access control lists of which services can write to which files, which registry settings, and things like that. And even though we're running a monoculture, even though we're all running Windows and stuff like that, what happens is my local security policy almost becomes a fingerprint for failure or a fingerprint of why this particular computer can't push such and such patch and why this computer particularly
so,
can't.
So you're saying that people screw up their GPO policies and that interferes with the operation of their third-party patch management software?
And it's not that they've screwed them up. It's that if you go into the lab and you get a default Windows 2012 box and you scan it with Nessus and do a patch audit, you're going to get results. And if you scan it with Big Fix, you know, you're going to go get the same results, right? But when you go into the field after it's been hardened, right, after a user's been on it making their own changes, after you've installed SQL Server and Exchange on top of that and fired up Lord knows what, that is now a little bit different. And this is where it's sort of that long tail of failures at that point where you actually have computers that are failing silently. And I say failing silently, they're not blue screening, right? They're, you know, the patch is getting partially installed and a DLL is not getting there right. Maybe an admin, you know, forced an install or copied a DLL over, did something manual like that. There's always something like that occurring that takes that machine sort of out of a known good state.
So how do you actually get around that? I mean, I think what you're saying is that that's a big driver for your customers to actually buy your software is because they can see when things have screwed up. But how do you actually go about setting up a policy that's going to allow everything to work properly?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I'm taking a very negative sort of view on this, right? But the reality is if people are using automation to push patches and push software, it's a very good thing, right? It's a lot better than having humans do it, right? The problem is that once you have 100% green, or you think you have 100% push, you might actually have a lot of failure back there. And if you start believing your systems, I'm sounding a little bit like Christopher Stoll here, you're talking about not trusting computers and whatnot. But if you start believing one system over another, that can really, really lead to some you know false negatives, some false positives, and obviously a lot of clashes between the people who are doing auditing and the people who are doing the administration.
Now, I understand that you guys have actually put out a pretty decent release of a passive vulnerability scanner. Is that right?
That's right. We've actually had the passive vulnerability scanner, you know, working on the enterprise side, working alongside our security center for many years, about 5-6 years. And what we did in this release is we actually have a version that's much like Nessus. It's got the same slick HTML5 web interface. It's got similar pricing and licensing. But basically, you can drop this in either on a Red Hat or Red Hat variant or Windows on a SPAN port and basically point it at a network, and it will automatically find every IPv6, every IPv4, every mobile, every client-side, every server-side vulnerability and bring it back into the GUI, much like as if you did a magical Nessus scan where all you had to do was sniff the traffic and get your results.
So this is really for pen testers, I imagine, who can go to a client site and just see how bad things are behind the curtain?
So when we were in at Black Hat, we had a little event. We invited a lot of people to come and kind of celebrate the release of PBS. And a lot of these people were pen testers. It's a time saver at the end of the day, right? So on one hand, maybe as a pen tester, you don't have credentials, right? So there's no way to know what the client side vulnerabilities are, whether it's a WGET, whether it's Internet Explorer, whether it's a some sort of service that's reaching out with some protocol like Oracle, TLS service listeners and things like that. The point is it's a time saver. Plug it in, sniff. You've got a lot of vulnerabilities before you even start your scanning.
So you plug it in and it tells you things.
Yes, almost immediately in some cases, and a lot of times if you're trying to do an audit, you might be able as a consultant to say, look, I've just sniffed your Windows 2003 server over here that you didn't even know about. I think it's 4 or 5 years old. Why don't you give me credentials just for that thing, and let me do a config audit of that, right? It's the kind of thing that gives you the evidence to be a much, much more effective penetration tester. Another thing you can do, or an auditor, another thing you can do is learn about the trust relationships. You can look at the network traffic, figure out who your top clients are and your top servers are, and then say, great, your customer in this case might have said, hey, here's my email server, here's my, I don't know, maybe a SharePoint server, but you might have said, hey, look, I've been sniffing your traffic. You actually have a lot of people going over here to this thing called Jive, going to this ticketing system called Jira, going to this FTP server, who knows? The point is, passively, you can figure out where people are going and then focus on those things as well.
All righty. Well, Ron Gula, congratulations on the new release. And thank you very much for joining us to chat about some of the insights you've gleaned after many years in the vulnerability discovery business.
And I have a feeling it will be many years longer. Thanks a whole lot, Patrick.
Ron Gula of Tenable Network Security there. Big thanks to Ron for that. And that is it for this week's show. This week's track is by Blue Juice, and it's dedicated to everyone at RSA, which this week put out an advisory warning customers to cease using random number generators in their development toolkits thought to be compromised by the NSA. So they're warning people not to use random number generators that they ship in their development environments. This track is called Vitriol, and I hope everyone at RSA HQ enjoys it. Until next week, I'm Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.